Hello and welcome. I'm Sam Harris, and it is my true honor and pleasure to host you here on the Growth Mindset podcast. I talk to amazing individuals about how they achieve their dreams and break down the strategies it takes to lead explosive tech businesses to being paid to travel the world. I deep dive into topics such as Bitcoin and fintech, or just how to get stuff done, with the goal of increasing our own collective wisdom and making us all happier, healthier, and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Welcome back to the podcast. Or if it's your first time listening, welcome to the podcast. So last week, I said I was hoping to release the podcast that I recorded in North Korea. But sadly, I'm still awaiting the finalization from the tour company that I went with about whether I can release this yet. And also the tour guide I recorded with has now left the company, which has made things all a little bit more confusing. So we're going to have to wait another week before I can release that. But this is a good chance for me to highlight one of the episodes from the start of the podcast that I feel deserves a lot more listens. So I'm going to do a repeat episode of the episode with Tom Carter, the founder and inventor of Ultra Haptics. So it's a seriously cool technology that has literally just won the Hottest Tech Innovation of the Year award at the Europas. So I figured it made sense to re-showcase this episode. And remember that you heard it here first, before they were famous. So I originally gave this episode quite a lengthy introduction, but I just don't think it's necessary. All you need to know is that Tom is awesome, the invention is awesome, and the interview is just pretty inspiring, and you should totally give it some time to enjoy.
Hey Tom, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. Yeah, can you introduce what it is your company does?
Yeah, sure. So I run Ultra Haptics, and we create a technology that lets you feel things in the air without touching anything. So broadly, we do two different types of things. One is let you control devices without touching them, Bluetooth speakers, the dashboard of your car.
But it feels like you're touching stuff.
But yeah, you can feel controls on your hand. And the other is virtual reality and augmented reality, being able to reach out and touch the virtual content around you and feel it.
Okay, so you're kind of like in a world of stuff that isn't there, but you're actually feeling force.
Yeah, you can pick things up, move them around, you can feel them, or you can feel things that don't actually exist in the real world, such as casting magic spells and feeling lightning leave your fingertips, whatever you want.
Okay, on the subject of magic, that sounds like magic. How does that work?
So we use ultrasound. So we have a small collection of essentially speakers that are emitting ultrasound. They're actually the parking sensors from the back of your car. And we trigger them with very specific time differences between them. So each one emits a sound wave. And what we're doing is making the sound waves arrive at the same point at the same time. And because sound is a pressure wave moving through the air, at that point, all of the pressure differences from all the sound waves add together. You get a very localized spot of high pressure, and there's enough force there for you to actually feel it. Just slightly displace the surface of your skin. And then we control that to create a vibration and create different sensations and different feelings.
But you can create like a whole image, but...
Yeah, so you can, the sort of focusing it to a point is the simplistic model. You can control the whole acoustic field of sound waves that you're putting out to sculpt it into 2D shapes or even three-dimensional shapes.
So it's kind of like a touch version of a hologram.
Yeah, exactly. It's literally being able to feel a hologram.
Okay, that's insane. So how did you have the idea for that? Like, were you looking into research, or were you just like, I just was so pissed off at not being able to touch things that aren't there. I need to need to touch stuff.
Not quite. I started work on it actually during my undergrad degree. So I did computer science at University of Bristol, and you have to do a research project in the final year of your degree. And I was interested in how you input and get feedback from computers. So I found a professor in the field. And it was at the time where Microsoft had just released the Kinect for Xbox, which had essentially taken being able to wave your hands in the air and control a computer from thousands of dollars to $150. So you can see this sort of ability to control things without touching them coming to the mass market. But it's the first time you've ever used your hands to operate a computer and actually not been able to feel anything at all. So we were thinking, okay, how do you solve that problem? How do you bring the sense of touch back? And my professor had this crazy idea that you might be able to feel ultrasound. So I thought that sounds like a really good way to fail my degree, chasing something crazy. Yeah, good fun to go and do.
Yeah, man, that sounds cool. So how long did it take from the point where you're like, oh, this is potentially an idea, to the first moment that you actually felt something?
That was probably quite a long time. By the end of my degree, you still couldn't feel anything. I mean, maybe you could feel like a tiny bit, but it wasn't working properly. That was, sort of 6 to 8 months, I'd say. Okay. So I actually pivoted and made it push small objects around a surface sort of horizontally. Yeah. So we made a game of Pong where the paddles were on a screen and the ball was real and the ball would bounce off the paddles. But for it actually to work, probably took another, 4 months or so after that. So it's probably getting on for a year from starting work to actually getting at what I would say is working properly.
Okay. That's still kind of fast for something like you're kind of not entirely sure it could even work and stuff.
So. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's working properly. You can feel something in the air using ultrasound. Then from that point, just push it into and a functional system where rather than just hold your hand here and you can feel something, you can tell somebody, do this and the system will respond. So you can actually do some kind of input and output to make something you can use to be able to demonstrate that. And then turning that from a lab prototype into an actual piece of hardware you could give somebody and they could use it as a whole different story.
Yeah, we can move on to that. So how did you keep motivation on trying to achieve that goal, or was it just you kind of knew it would work? And
I think the fundamental idea looked sound, so it looks like it should work. The maths, the evidence, everything points to it being able to work. The physics, my professor convinced that it will work. And you get the odd glimmer of something getting a little bit closer. So really for me, it was kind of I can't see why it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
That's sort of taking it back to fundamentals of physics and maths. So therefore it must be able to work. So if it doesn't work now, that means you're doing it wrong.
Okay.
Just keep trying. it was a bit of a long struggle, but
yeah. It's like when you're coding and stuff, it's sort of, you're not sure something will work, but usually someone's already done it and you're just like, I'm being stupid, something will somehow work. But when you're trying to invent something, you're like, I don't know, will it work? I'll just keep trying, maybe this is a better way. Or
I mean, all inventions are built upon other existing work. So
what was out there already? Had other people tried to do what you guys were doing?
Other people had made some kind of had made sensations, so that's sort of a good point. So people had been able to feel ultrasound, so that gives you a good, well, they've managed to do it in some way, shape or form. I've never been able to feel that, so but pretty sure that it does exist. The field goes right back to the 1970s and Soviet Russia, if you follow it right back. And
did you follow it?
I did, yeah. It gets a little bit crazy. It's using it to beam ultrasound through and actually move your nerve endings inside your hands, which is probably not particularly good for you, but really interesting science. So there's a lot of different aspects such as that, such as other experiments that other people have done that you can look at and say, okay, they've done something in a similar area or a similar direction. There's medical ultrasound as well, being able to focus ultrasound inside your body. There's non-destructive testing, actually being able to put ultrasound inside of bridges and structures. So there's a lot of other bits out there that you can look at and pull information from to stick it together and think, this should definitely work.
Okay. So when you first started off, that was just like a research, let's see if I can do something. How did you then go about going from that point to, let's see if I can sell this and make this a business?
I think I kind of came about it in a bit of an odd direction. So during my degree, I also did an enterprise module.
Okay.
So taught how to write business plans and all the sort of business fundamentals. And the final part of that is that you have to write a business plan and then you pitch it to a sort of Dragon's Den style panel. So for that, I did pitching what was eventually Ultra Haptics, the sort of the idea that I was working on. and that sort of started putting all of the blocks together of how you could package this up, how you could sell it, how it could be useful. And then so really going from doing that in my undergrad degree to doing a PhD on it, which was my next step, was, okay, I think this can become a business. I think this can be for a start, I think it can be useful. I think it's a technology that people actually want and use, and you can see how you can put it into products. I think that there's a good potential to actually make a business out of it, but the technology is not ready yet. It doesn't work properly. It needs more development. So that's kind of was the main reason for doing a PhD.
Out of interest, did you come top in your class for the business pitch with which you pitched Ultra Haptics, or did other people do much better than your now very well?
For the business pitch, I think I might have done. I was certainly up near the top.
Okay, so you did do well.
Yeah, I think the pitch model was a pitch module was on, you know, how well you do put a pitch together and put a business plan together. And I've always quite liked that sort of the business and entrepreneurship and this kind of area. So I've always looked into them and read about them. So I guess I had a little bit of an advantage in that it was something I was probably more interested in than a lot of my classmates.
Okay. So I wasn't really sure how into business and stuff you were. It's like when we spoke to you more about like the science side of things and business things seem to like just be happening.
I'm somebody who's always wanted to start a business and run a company, but my mindset was wait for the right idea rather than just sort of do lots of things and iterate to get better at running businesses, which is in hindsight possibly the wrong way of doing it. But it's worked well for me, and that I managed to find a good idea while I was still fairly young. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you're able to invent something as good as just being able to touch stuff that isn't there, then sure, wait for that idea to come around. But for most people, maybe perhaps trying something.
Yeah, my advice would not be to do what I did, but get out there and try stuff. Certainly don't wait till life locks you down or you have children or mortgages or any of that kind of stuff.
Okay. Cool. So as you're clearly into business then, has it been a kind of a fun ride, a scary ride, now that you've been trying to raise, you've been trying and successfully raising quite a lot of money? And
yeah, both of those things. I think so far we're definitely in the nice period where generally everything's going well.
Yeah, we've had very few read any bad news.
No. Thankfully, we've not had to deal with any bad news. Largely think everything inside the company's gone very well as well, so I know we've not really had a hit our big road bump yet, which every company does, so I'm sure we will at some point. But still there's still scary going out and hiring lots of people and raising lots of money and then turning around and seeing a room full of people who are all sort of effectively looking at you to find so this is all going to work out okay, right? I've got my life depending on this now. You're definitely going in the right direction. You're sort of looking after that. So, very rewarding at the same time.
What was it like as the founder finding someone to run your company for you and getting a new CEO?
That was pretty easy for me to do. Yeah. I think I had that mindset from the beginning. This is possibly why I didn't want to go out and iterate on running other companies to learn that aspect, but more so learn it by bringing somebody in who knows what they're doing. The purpose of going out and finding a CEO to run the company was basically speed. I'm generally, with these type of things, very impatient. So on the business side, me learning everything means every time there's something new that I don't know, I've got to go and find somebody to ask or sit down and work it out myself. And things are going to go wrong and things are going to take time. You'll learn a lot from doing that. But for me, that's a slower process than bringing somebody in to be the CEO, handle the business side, allowed me also to focus on the technology, which I thought if I didn't focus on the technology in the early stages of the company, we could get the business absolutely right. But if the technology didn't make the strides it needed to, we weren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, I think that was definitely the right move. I think that's played out as I'd hoped for. So.
Okay. So maybe like in 5 years' time when you sort of invent flying cars or something, you'll be like,
I'll do that. Now. Flying cars are a terrible idea, but
yeah. Well, I wouldn't mind if my car flew.
But you would mind if your neighbour's car flew if you haven't attached his hubcap properly.
Yeah. Crap idea, Sam. But what if you weren't running this business, have you had any other ideas come into your head now? That you're like, I've had some time.
I think you see a lot of other companies, it's difficult to work out what's the sort of things that came into your head and you go, oh, this would be a really good idea, but actually you saw something a couple of days ago and then it links in. I've seen a lot of other companies who I look at and go, like, these guys are definitely have the right idea, they're doing a really fantastic company. Myself, I have a couple of ideas tucked away for the future, but otherwise...
But not sharing them then.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. You don't want to give away too much. So what about employing people? Because you've grown... How many people do you have now?
We are now, I think we're 74 today. Okay, somewhere between
2 years ago, how many people were you?
2 years ago, we would have been probably something like 14.
Okay, so that's pretty huge growth.
Yeah. We nearly quadrupled at each of the first three company Christmas parties, I think. So
that's insane. Yeah. Cool. So loads of questions around that. Well, how do you employ people that are going to be a good fit? Do you have any favorite questions to ask people?
I have a couple of favorite questions. I'm generally a fan of not overly structuring the interview process. In some ways, it seems like you should ask each candidate the same questions, so you're being fair and giving everybody the same choices. But yeah. I think in some ways that's also unfair because some of the questions might be very tailored to somebody and not quite somebody else's strengths. So I more enjoy sort of more open conversations about what they've been doing and trying to find what they're good at and what they enjoy. I really focus on almost regardless of the job role, what they enjoy doing, what they are most proud of doing, and what they feel they're best at doing. Because then it kind of gives you a good indication of if the role can put them in that position, then they're going to be happy and they're going to work really hard and they're going to do really well, hopefully have a good time. Whereas if they're good at that, but the role is something else, and you think, well, they can still do that other role, and maybe you're squeezing them in. We've been lucky in that we've been hiring so fast that we can generally have a job spec, have a person come in and apply for that job spec, but maybe there's multiple positions available either behind that job spec or with other job specs that are out at the time. So you can bring somebody in for interview and then work out, okay, what can we do with this person?
Where
can we put them? Which I think is better.
That's cool. I was going to ask if you've had any people that like applied and then ended up being appropriate for something else.
Yeah, definitely. One of the people I hired most recently actually applied for a completely different position, even in a different country, actually. Wow. And then I hired him in a different country because it fit his lifestyle better. So why are you applying for this job here? Do you actually want to move country? Mm. Well, not really, but I like the look of the job. Okay, well, then we'll do this job instead and then shape it around the person.
But also on that note, what's your success rate of people that interview for you? Do you kind of only hire 2% of people or something?
I think it varies massively depending on the position.
Mm.
Some positions we've got to the right person very, very quickly. Some positions didn't even exist when somebody came for interview. So by default, they were the first person to interview and got the job. Other positions have been a bit more difficult to hire and we've gone through quite a few people. I don't actually know what the overall average percentage is, but generally the way we do it is we try and screen people on CVs and maybe telephone interviews. And my ideal is to get it down to 4 candidates who all look like they could do the job and bring them all in on the same day. The people who interview them are all the same. They see everybody. And at the end of the day, we go, so question one, is there somebody in that group who could do the job? Yes. Okay. Then who's the best one? And have a discussion.
Okay, cool. Have you ever not hired people that you wish you could have hired?
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes life and their requirements don't fit what the company has at that point in time. And we've had people who sort of the primary problem we had on a couple of occasions has been salary. Essentially, there's been somebody really good, but at that stage of the company, we couldn't pay those salaries. So, and they weren't willing to take a sort of a pay cut for the next X number of months while we bring them back up, which is sort of perfectly understandable. You've got to look after your family, so it happens on occasion. But that's life. You've got to find a match between person and company.
Okay. Then also, how do you go about maintaining a culture when you're growing so fast?
Yeah, that's a good one. You have to, I think, let the culture evolve on its own. I think when you're a very small company and everybody sits in the same room, then the culture is easier to almost, even though you shouldn't dictate it, but just what you do kind of sets the culture because you're there and you're in the room. And if you're at the top of the company, people are going to look up to you more than other people. So naturally you will set more of the culture. as the company gets bigger, then really now, I think there's nothing you can do to force it. And I don't think you should force it. You should let it grow on its own. But you should make sure that you're giving people the space to sort of work out what they are, trying to set broad boundaries. So we have an open plan office. We want people to jump up out of their seats and go and solve problems by talking to each other and writing on whiteboards. So there are write-on walls around the office. And you can sort of put the infrastructure and the environment around them to push it in the right direction that you want. For example, when we moved into our new office and sort of bare, empty office floor of a building that we then kitted out, we built it around the kitchen, because in the place we were previously, everybody used to stand up at the same time, walk out, go get lunch together, and then sit downstairs and have a chat and then have lunch together. And we thought that's a really good part of the culture of the company.
Yes.
So if you move to a different office, then everybody starts eating at the desk, you can kind of break that entirely. So the kitchen is kind of the focal point of the whole office. And still today, everybody in the company goes out, has their lunch, and just sits in this now rather large room full of people. And it's very noisy, lots of talking. Kind of key. And you get people from different parts of the company talking to each other then. Mm. You sit on the complete opposite side of the office. So.
Cool. Do you have any other ways to encourage culture, like ping pong tables or?
We don't have any, I guess, games in the office. I mean, we have a lot of VR setups because we use them for work, so people play games on those. But we don't have ping pong tables. There's two reasons for that. One is the square footage needed for a ping pong table actually makes them pretty expensive when you work out the rent for a ping pong table. But also, I think something I actually adopted from Slack. So Slack is a Silicon Valley company, sort of, and I was competing with the likes of Dropbox, which has masseuses and everything you can imagine at work. And Slack has very little in their office for staff entertainment. And their notion is come to work, work really hard, be happy, and then go home and see your family and your friends and, you know, have a life outside of work as well. You don't have to be entirely satisfied within the office walls. Go and enjoy the rest of the city. And I think that makes a lot of sense. People will be happier if you let them out on occasion.
Well, Bristol is a good city for that as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I've been to Palantir's office and, like, it's insane. Like chefs and stuff are cooking for you, like, all meals of the day and unlimited amounts of amazing food and nice things to do. But you're like, well, I don't want to live at work, but that's kind of what they want you to do.
And yeah, exactly. It's to try and get more hours out of you. But
yeah,
there's a lot of research that suggests just working more hours or being in an environment longer hours doesn't actually make you more productive. Mm. And there's kind of this peak and this plateau where once you do a certain number of hours a week, it'll vary based on the person, any more than that, and you're going to do the same or less work overall. So
yeah, definitely.
I'm not sure that's the best. I've met a lot of people from some of these big companies that have everything that then want to leave because after a couple of years of working there, they suddenly realize they're starting to feel a bit detached from
anything else,
the rest of the world. Like, you know, they just walk in, have their laundry done.
Yeah,
I mean, it sounds amazing. Let's not kid ourselves, but you kind of wonder whether you're losing the skills to do normal life while you're there. Yeah, I guess.
I bet. That's crazy. Yeah, well, for me, in terms of being productive hours, I find, like, if I can do like 3 hours in the morning and then kind of chill out over lunch, have a nap, and like I'll do like an amazing amount of like work then later in the evening. But you can't really get a job where you're just allowed to like chill out all afternoon and have a nap.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating.
I guess unless you work in work for a Silicon Valley company in the UK or something, so the time zones will let you.
Yeah, it's true.
But then you have to work to midnight.
Yeah, which is kind of impractical if you also have friends and you want to go do stuff in the evening. So it's my life. You've now raised $23 million?
$23 million, yeah.
Okay, it's that's still
just under £18 million. Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you go about raising your first round of money?
So we've done, I got it wrong, I think we've actually done three rounds. We did seed, series A, and this was series B. Oh,
crikey.
So the seed round, we knew IP Group, who is our seed round investor. They've been with us since the beginning, because before spinning out of the university, they had a relationship with the university, which was great because it means we got to meet them before spinning the company out. And then once we formed the company, myself and the two other founders, we stuck some cash in to get it going. And then basically we took this guy, invited him to some meetings in Las Vegas at the Consumer Electronics Show. So we'd just gone to CES. We'd never been before. We'd never run a company before. It was just the three of us in a hotel room in Las Vegas having meetings with some crazily large companies who decided they'd actually come to the meeting, which is kind of surprising. And we had him there for a few of the meetings, which was great because he kind of helped out on some of the business aspects of having the meetings, but also was effectively his way of doing due diligence on the company, just attend the meetings, see if there is any pull for the technology from the potential customers. And at the end of it said, yeah, okay, I'm happy. And that's sort of what got the ball rolling.
Okay, that's cool. And then how did you go about working out? So you still, is it available yet? Like, is there any hardware out there that I could buy in public that would have haptics in it?
Right now, you can only buy sort of development kits and devices from us and from distributors. It's pretty soon that you'll be able, that there'll be products out on the market with the technology, and I think you'll see it both sort of, I guess, products and things out there later this year, but also installations in these kind of immersive environments. We've done some public installations that were temporary, but I think we'll see some more permanent ones coming out in the pretty near future.
Make money initially, or did you rely more on funding?
We're definitely a company that needs funding. We're a licensing company, so ultimately where we really start making revenue is when the royalties start coming in, so when people are really actually selling volumes of products with our technology in. So we are, I guess, your stereotypical venture-backed company that is loss, and then suddenly profit.
Okay. So it's still a lot to play for, but...
Yeah, but we've made... we've had quite a lot of revenue so far from our evaluation program, which we launched at the beginning, working with customers and sort of early projects, and then collaborative projects where a customer wants us to customize the technology and get it bespoke just for their product, or help with the integration of our technology into their product, or even help with the design and user experience, I guess, of the whole system that they're creating.
Okay, cool.
So we do quite a lot of that.
Yeah. Back to culture. Do you, now that you've been going to CES more regularly, so I saw you had like a team of like 10 of you or something went this year.
I mean, 16.
Yeah. Is the rest of the office a bit like, why aren't we in CES? Or are they all pretty chill about it?
I think people are generally okay. I mean, we try and share around the opportunities for CES is our biggest event, but there's plenty of other events that we get people out and doing. I'm very keen on, you know, always pushing people slightly further than they've done before. One thing we do quite a lot, it seems about every year we end up having some kind of demo and presentation to school children, and I really like getting particularly new engineers to go and do that, because school children have the best reaction to trying the technology, and you get to sort of stand there and say, hey, I know I made this, and then they test it out. It's good education, but also you get that sort of sense of here's people's reaction to what you're doing. And then there's always people who don't actually want to get on a plane and go to Las Vegas. So yes, it's quite hard work. It's really good fun, but it's a proper slog for 6 days of nonstop talking to people who are all ill in an air-conditioned room. So
cool. And so for Ultra Haptics, your goal is to IPO?
We don't have a set necessary plan for the future. We're just concentrating on growing the company to be as big as it can be. I think that's been the goal since we founded it, myself and the other founders, and it's been the same when we managed to find investors that hold the same view and brought on Steve, CEO, and another management team that either were aligned from the beginning or I guess have aligned as they've joined the company, that regardless of any future plans, the best objective is just to try and grow the company as big as possible. I think if you try and aim to sell your company, then on the one hand, I think you might end up underselling yourself because you're aiming for this when you don't know what the potential is. But also, that's just something I'd find quite hard to motivate myself to do. Yeah. I'm not hugely financially motivated, so selling the company is not my big end goal, and getting out of bed to go and try and work really hard so that I can make something for somebody else to buy is...
Yeah.
Maybe that's how it's going to end up, and maybe that'll be great, and they can take it on and do some great stuff with it. But growing something big is the exciting thing to do.
Yeah, that's cool. It'd be awesome when, in a few years' time, it is just a bit more part of everyday life.
Yeah.
Pretty excited for it. Have you had any offers to sell your company?
no sort of proper full out offers. We occasionally have sort of and this is part of the setting, the tone of we're here to grow a large company. I think it was in the not the company wasn't that old, and somebody on the management team got an email saying from a person from a large company, and his signature had M&A department in it. Yeah. And so he sent it around saying, "Ooh, you know," almost like a little buzz of excitement. So their immediate reply was, "That's interesting. I didn't think they'd want us to buy them already." Yeah. Being a tiny startup, but setting that idea of, "Hey, we're trying to build something big here, and we'll see what happens."
That's funny. So how many hours away do you? How? What the hell? Hours? hours a day do you work?
That again, I guess varies a lot. Yeah. I try not to work too much on the weekends. For a start, I think it's good to get out and do other stuff.
Is it hard to confine yourself?
I think it has been. I'm fairly good at it these days. I don't set sort of strict boundaries between work and not work. Mm-hmm. But I think working on what I've done a lot of over the last year or two is working on sort of your personal system for keeping on top of everything that you've got to do and your deadlines and what's happening, and knowing how to delegate the right things to the right people and how to check in on them and not hold everything in your head. Mm. So that makes a huge difference in that I can now home and be calm and happy and check in on emails occasionally, but without sort of getting loads of stress or losing attention, because I know things are in the right place and things are under control. Occasionally things spiral out of control, and that's when you need to put the extra hours in and sort it out. But having some kind of mechanism where you know that you don't have to be thinking about everything all the time, and your thoughts are stored in some system somewhere, and they'll be there and in good shape when you get back, or other people have it under control is the key, I think.
So you said you picked up some tips from like Slack on how they run things. Have you had any kind of tips from entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley and stuff around the way you keep your life together then?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are very different, and there's a lot of bravado around as well. I think that one of the things that I think is just starting to change is this whole concept that the best people in Silicon Valley all work nonstop all the time and sleep basically. You know, as Elon Musk is famous for, everybody knows that he's always working and he never ever sleeps, and yet he's very high level on some online computer games, because actually he plays computer games quite a lot as his way of unwinding, and you know, he has a family and he goes and does this other stuff. But there's this kind of image that people portray, and I think that is changing with a lot of books and research coming out saying actually you need to get a proper amount of sleep and then you'll do better and make better decisions. I read Getting Things Done, which is a pretty old school, I guess would have once been considered mildly stuffy even, management book for sorting out your stuff. And I read it once and went, nah. And then read it again about a year later when I felt like, actually, it might be useful now. And then that's kind of the main thing that I've used and implemented. And I keep going back and finding extra things to put in place and do. And for me, it's worked incredibly well.
Okay. Do you have any other book tips for life or just...
I'm currently reading The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm very much enjoying. Mm. I think that's it's a completely different book to a lot that I've read, in that it actually doesn't sugarcoat things, doesn't pretend that it's a scenario where, hey, you're starting a business. If you do these things, everything will go swimmingly well and you'll be hugely successful, just like I was. It's very much everything's going to go wrong at some point, and here's how you deal with those situations, which I think is probably a lot more useful for the long term.
Mm. Yeah, I interviewed a CTO of Settled two podcasts before this who recommended that, so I just listened to it on audio and it was really good. So it's been the most recommended book of this podcast so far.
other book, it's nothing that you would learn from in any sort of, it's not a management book or anything like that, but Ready Player One is a great fiction book about virtual reality. It's sci-fi and in the year 2050, I think, but you can see a lot of the current virtual reality industry. I know it was Palmer Luckey's favorite book, the founder of Oculus, and you can kind of see a lot of that book in Oculus and the way they're setting themselves up. And there's a lot of interesting ideas and goes through a lot of the problems and I guess the challenges that will exist once everybody's in VR and AR all the time. So, and it's really good fun.
Thanks. I'm definitely keen to get hold of that. Do you know if it's an audio version or do I have to buy it?
Yeah, I've started reading books with my ears now. That was the first one I read on Audible, and now I have a subscription, and now I'm listening to everything. So
yeah, it's pretty handy, like the amount of stuff you can get in. Yeah, do you find a lot of time for reading otherwise?
I read websites, blogs, papers, this kind of thing. If I'm sat at my laptop or on my phone, I do that quite a lot. I struggle to read books when I'm able to do other things. So that's why I think Audible's changed a lot. It started off with me listening to loads of podcasts and now a load of books and Audible. Whenever I'm doing something where I can't be doing anything else, but I can listen. So
cooking,
walking. Gym, driving, mowing the lawn, cycling. Put one earbud in while I'm cycling. I can't listen to an audiobook if I'm not doing something that occupies my hands, if you like, because I'll start reading something else or doing something else.
Yeah, it's a problem. But do you not find it a bit too loud on the lawnmower? Because I was trimming the hedge this weekend and I was trying to listen to an audiobook and couldn't. And it was like, oh, nightmare.
Good headphones, I guess.
Great.
Noise isolating headphones.
Those ones, but they got stolen.
Ones are essential if you fly.
I can't
fly without one of those headphones now. It sounds very needy, but they make a huge difference.
Oh yeah, I'm so attached to them. I've been attached to my current ones, but they're like sort of 60 quid as opposed to sort of 300 quid. Because I'm like, oh, if I break them more, I guess all that's fine. But they're just not as good. And
when I started flying a lot, I went, okay, fine. Got some Bose headphones. Thought they're really expensive and they probably won't be quite as good as I want. Plane took off, put the headphones on, sort of clicked on the noise cancellation and went, oh, I can still hear the plane engine. Like it's not as good as I was expecting it to be. And so I was like, oh, well, never mind. You know, at least they're nice headphones. Sat there and did some work or something on the plane. And then an hour or two later, the trolley came along and asking if they wanted anything. And I took the headphones off to talk to them and just, I think I like shouted because I was like, whoa, it's so loud out here. Because you don't really quite realize until you've sat in a nice piece of your headphones for a while.
I got mine because I was working in a server room and it was so noisy.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't really like talk to each other. It was that bad.
Yeah.
And I got them and it was like, wow, I can actually carry on with my job for a bit now because otherwise I literally couldn't have done it.
That kind of loud, continuous fan noise is quite fatiguing. It makes you tired just by hearing it.
Cool. So on a different note, do you have a secret hunch about how you will die?
Secret hunch about how I die. Hopefully I'll die happy. Generally no. No death plans.
No?
I don't really think about death at all, really. I'm one of these people who doesn't get worried about events or terrorism events. It never really phases me about personal safety or any of that kind of thing. I don't really think about the end, more just about what I'm doing at the moment and keep having fun.
With the whole going to Silicon Valley, are you interested in like life extension?
Do you know, I occasionally do this. So when talking about reading, I'll listen to a podcast or do something and then just end up diverting on some random track for a few days of reading about a lot of stuff. And I've read into this a bunch and I think life extension is absolutely the last thing I want.
Yeah. So you're keen to die at like...
I'm keen to die at a sensible age. So essentially over the last century, we've steadily made life expectancy of humans longer.
Mm.
But if you look at your health span rather than your lifespan, when you're actually healthy, that's pretty similar length. And then you just have this end bit tagged on where you're stretching out the last stages of life rather than extending any others.
Yeah.
So the research is going on to extending your health span so that you can be really healthy. You could be sort of 70 years old and be the equivalent of a 40-year-old in terms of health and well-being. You can still go skiing. You can still go and start a business. And I mean, some people are lucky enough to be in good enough health when they're 70 to go and start businesses and do kind of crazy, stressful, exciting stuff. But I think that's the more interesting thing for me, being healthy longer.
Yeah. So, but do you do things to try and keep yourself healthier then?
Like... Yeah, I eat as well as I can. So I cycle to work every day. So I do 10-mile cycling every day. I run occasionally. So try and keep healthy. Usually spurred on by a trip to the US where you end up in, or traveling anywhere else where you go for a week or two and end up in hotels and and restaurant food available. So that's kind of a good incentive to try and eat healthily the rest of the time and do some exercise, get in the gym.
You're 27?
28.
28, okay. And you got married 2 years ago?
Nearly 2 years, yeah. Okay. 2 years in August.
So was that kind of difficult, managing a whole marriage during like key periods of growing a business?
Yes and no. I think yes, in that getting married is quite a big job and fairly stressful and lots to do, and you have this sort of constant push and pull of your time. But no, in the sense that that's in some ways a good thing to have that other other activity outside. But also my now wife is incredibly well organized and very smart and handled a lot of the, a lot of the wedding. So she kind of ran the show on the wedding and did a fantastic job, and I did my bits and helped out on the choosing. So that took a lot of the sting out of it.
Cool. You went to the wedding. That was really important part.
Yeah, I turned up. She was capable of managing to do two jobs at the same time effectively, and I guess normally part-timed on the wedding and did my job.
Cool. So on the family side of things, you got married so early, what do you think about kids?
Because not for a while.
Yeah.
I think we both wanted to get married, both wanted to sort of start building our life. Not that we didn't need to get married, but generally I think for us the wedding was neither of us a religious, so it wasn't about a sort of a formal religious ceremony. It was more about just throwing a really big party with a lot of our friends. So that was really good fun, and we wanted to do that well and kind of get it out the way before too many other people had weddings and children. But we've got places to explore around the world before any children or settling down. So
okay, what about pets?
Have a cat.
Yeah
I've had a cat nearly a year now called Simba. Absolute nightmare. very cute, keeps our company when I'm traveling around the world. Usually it's the last night I was in London, and I think she was woken up at 3 a.m. by the cat desperately trying to get through the door, or going and meowing outside the window or something, or tearing up our furniture. So keeps us busy just with putting our house back together and but good overall.
So you regret the cat?
No, I don't regret the cat. definitely worth it overall, but more to deal with.
Okay.
A good primer for realizing that we don't want kids yet.
Yeah, sure. If you could wake up tomorrow having gained one quality or ability, what would it be?
Wow. I assume outside of the supernatural, being able to stop time or that kind of thing.
That can be the next question.
Sure. One quality or ability. That's a really good question. I think I'm still going through the process of the whole experience of growing the company. I think because we've been growing so fast, and I have never run a company before. I think it's difficult to learn how to run a company or be sort of senior manager in a company without doing it. You can watch other people do it, but I think you kind of have to do it from my tiny amount of experience that I have. But it kind of means you're constantly learning how to do the job that you're currently in. And because the company keeps growing, it keeps changing. So just by the time I've worked out what I'm supposed to be doing, the whole company has changed. And so my job has changed as well. So I guess if I had one skill, I'd be able to be good at what my job is going to be tomorrow. Or be experienced in that. That would be useful, but equally kind of, I guess, less fun.
Do you think it would be
entertaining and pleasing and working it out as you go, and in some ways the company kind of grows with you as you work out what you're doing.
Do you feel like kind of half the enjoyment is in the challenge? Like if you were just sort of doing something that you're good at and knew what you're doing every day, it would be a bit more boring?
I don't think I could ever do something that is just easy and routine and not challenging. So and being sort of running a company, there's so many different facets. So I have my role as CTO, where progressing the technology forwards. I've been in a PhD research lab. I've been in a small company. Now we're on our way to a 100-person company we could be in the not-too-distant future. How do you run an R&D team in a 100-person company? What does that look like? That's an exciting thing to explore. And also knowing that you can look at how a lot of other people are doing it, but also come up with new ways yourself and new structures for your company. But then there's also the founder side, which kind of covers a lot of other stuff. And a lot of that is people being able to work out suddenly that you're responsible for a lot of people. How do you have somebody come and join your company and their time there is beneficial to them in that it makes them progress through their career or as a person? When you have realized that you've done that on for somebody and something has helped them and they've jumped forwards as a person or as a or in their career, it's sort of hugely satisfying to be like, oh, I think I'm starting to get this. And that's a very rewarding thing to do.
Cool. Okay, so if you could gain one superpower.
Good question. A time would probably be a good one. I always try and pack a lot of stuff into time, and it would always be good to have twice as much time as you actually have.
Would you like to be able to kind of live the same day twice and just be somewhere else, or would you like to just be able to like stop time and just work for like an extra 2 hours with nothing else happening in the world?
Probably the latter. Sort of it's those times when you get conflicts of I'd really like to go and do this, but I also really need to get this finished. Being able to just press stop, get that finished, and then go and take that opportunity as well, I think would be great. Okay. The other one that has just popped in my head is the ability to teleport, because then I wouldn't have to fly anywhere. And you could
wouldn't need your headphones either.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Nice. Okay, and then the last question, I think, because I'm aware you have to catch a train soon. Assuming that your house is burning down and the cat and your wife are safe, what would be the one item you would grab?
Good question. There's going to be something. So I'm really not very materialistic. I won't go into it. I went through something a couple of years ago where I effectively nearly lost all of my possessions.
Wow.
And it was a bit of a hard time, but it wasn't that scary in losing the possessions because stuff is stuff. And as long as I've got what I need to do what I'm doing, I'm not too fussed about other stuff. But I'm sure there's some sentimental stuff around the house, but there's a lot of different options. I'm not sure which one I'd go for first. With things from the wedding, that would be really good to go and collect. I'm trying to remember which stuff is, like, there's the wedding album, but then that's probably backed up and I'd probably get that elsewhere. Various little artifacts and odds and things. I can't really think of one thing off the top of my head.
So, like, when I said you're going traveling, you can only pack one item, would it be like your Bose headphones or a Kindle?
I'd probably take some kind of clothing, but yeah, assuming I'm wearing that.
Yeah.
If I can only take one thing traveling.
What can you not live without for like a week?
I can't live without my phone.
Yeah.
I'm probably like a lot of people, entirely reliant on it. Like I said, everything that I need to remember or I need to know or that I've ever done is somewhere stored on my phone in to-do list app or Evernote. Every time I meet somebody, I write things down in Evernote. Literally, my brain is there. I don't remember anything. I just remember where to find it.
Yeah.
So if I don't have my phone, I'm pretty screwed as a human being.
And on the to-do list thing, did you go on to the new Microsoft one? So, really?
I haven't, no. I think what they're doing is really interesting. They're making this mechanism where you have all of your list for all of your stuff, and then you have your today list where you filter things through into what you're doing today. And it has some AI to try and help you build that list every day. But that's not how I work. I don't work on a here's the things I'm going to do today basis.
Yeah.
I work on the sort of GTD method of I have a whole load of projects and sort of singular actions that I need to do. And I just have marked for each of those what's the next thing I need to do and then keep them ordered in top to bottom. And it's one of the nice things actually I've shifted away from the I have a list of things to do and I need to finish more today, or I have a list of things I need to do, I need to finish them this week. Because invariably you always overestimate what you can get done, or other stuff comes up, which means every day you go home thinking there's still stuff on the list that you haven't done, which is a source of frustration. Whereas if you just have one sort of never-ending list and just get to grips with the fact that there's always going to be numerous hundred things on the list that you need to do, it's okay that the list is never going to end. You're going to keep filling it. As long as you're doing the most important things at any point in time, then you know you're doing the right thing, so you can kind of relax about the rest.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Where can we find out more? So Twitter?
Twitter, I am Tom Carter. Okay. Instagram, the same, I think.
Your Twitter handle is I am
Tom Carter. I am Tom Carter, yes, the words.
Randomly state that.
Just my name again.
Yeah.
Or obviously the company website, ultrahaptics.com.
Okay, cool. All right, and I'll put notes in the on the podcast about books and everything if people want to find out more. And thank you very much for coming.
Thanks a lot.
I don't think that paused it.
Man, what a totally awesome episode. My mind is slightly blown from too much good advice. But I will try and distill them into my top tips for you, as always. So, one, culture. I love the way he thinks about making a nice culture in the workplace without trying to take over people's lives to just get more out of them. Allow people more freedom from work. So, just a normal 9-to-5. Don't try and squeeze extra hours out of them. They can go home, they can enjoy the money that they earn, and live their own social lives. Then, whilst they're at work, they can just be happier and work harder. And also, make sure you make the most out of lunch times. They're a good way for the team to bond and get some downtime. Consider this in the way you lay out your office to make sure that you cultivate a good use of lunch times. 2. Focus on your strengths. I've got a lot of respect for the way Tom freely accepted taking on an incoming CEO so early on in the business. It gave the company the management experience it needed to scale rapidly and allowed Tom to focus on driving innovation. Be willing to get better people to do things that you can't do as well. This can help you achieve far more in the long run, and you might learn a thing or two from them in the process. 3. Hiring. Tom has gained so much insight from conducting numerous interview conversations in a rapidly scaling company that has experienced barely any turnover of staff. He approaches interviews as a more open conversation with people rather than a structured process. He aims to just get a good feel for what they would be like and what they could be doing for you. They might even have a role in your company that you weren't specifically interviewing for. Make a point to ask questions like, what are they proud of doing? What do they enjoy doing? What are they best at doing? When hiring for a top position, just screen candidates until you can get 4 people that you feel can do the job. Get them all in on the same day and interview them. After that, have a meeting, and if you can all agree that one can definitely do the job, don't waste time overthinking it and just hire them. Tom's top book recommendations. The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. This has already been recommended once, and is the tale of starting and growing a business to $1 billion, losing it all, getting it back, nearly losing it, starting more. It's just a really good story about success and failure and all the crap that goes with it and dealing with hard things, basically. And you should read it. He also recommends Getting Things Done. It's just a standardly very useful book about just being an efficient human being and making the most of your time. Find top tips on maximizing your time to achieve your goals that you can start implementing from day one. It might not be the most exciting book, but if you're struggling to keep up with your task list or want to become better at achieving your goals, then this should probably be at the top of your list to read. Ready Player One. Since recording the podcast with Tom, I have now read this book, and I can tell you, it is amazing. I listened on Audible and literally listened to the whole thing in about 2.5 days whilst I was traveling in Kazakhstan. I just couldn't stop listening. It's such an engaging read. Like Tom says, it's got a really interesting perspective view on the future that just gives a bit of a scary insight into some of the possibilities facing us. But it also appeals to the geek in you and has a lot of 70s and 80s references. So I sort of put it somewhere in between The Matrix meets Guardians to the Galaxy, maybe, but based in a more possible reality. And it's just a really well-written novel in general, so highly recommend it. All of the tips and books are summarized in the show notes, and I provide a link to find any of them or get a free Audible trial if you want to listen. I'd love to know what you learned from the episode, so feel free to leave a comment or start a conversation with me on Twitter. Certainly, me and Tom would be happy to geek out about Ready Player One if you so wish. You've listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for this show or you just want to reach out, I'd love to talk to you. On Twitter, I am at Sam Harris Tweets, or Instagram, Sam Jam Snaps. Show notes, along with links to everything that we discuss, are available at growthmindsetpodcast.com, along with information on how to get involved and blog posts on cool things that you should be aware of. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy your next podcast.